You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 59 of the Social Media and Politics podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or swing by our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today, we're going to be looking at the Internet of Things and some of the potential threats it poses to cybersecurity, which sounds like it's a bit outside the realm of social media and politics. But as appliances become more interconnected, so let's say you start your car from your smart speaker to warm it up in the winter, what unites all of these appliances is that they're driven by computers and they are all connected to the internet. So there's an interesting dynamic where as systems become more interconnected and complex, they also become more vulnerable because a breach in one system can spill over to another. And in this environment of hyperconnectivity, which is where the Internet of Things is going, there's the potential risk of some pretty catastrophic events. So we can think of things like a malicious actor disabling the brakes of an autonomous vehicle, or messing with airline technology to down planes, or breaking into smart grids, which we've already seen happen. So I was curious as to how social media fits into this equation, because as we've discussed in previous episodes, social media can be used as a beachhead or an attack vector that would infiltrate government secrets or breach a system or steal personal information that can be used for a variety of malicious purposes. So joining me today to talk more about the Internet of Things, computer security, and the role of social media in the Internet of Things is Bruce Schneier. He is the Chief Technology Officer at IBM Resilient, and he's also a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard University. And Bruce is an expert in security technology as well as cryptography. He's written many books on the subject, but today we're going to talk about his latest, which is Click Here to Kill Everybody, Security and Survival in a Hyperconnected World. And I think even if you're not so interested in the sort of back end of systems and, you know, computer security, I think some of the dynamics we talk about in this episode are very relevant for how social media companies and tech companies more broadly fit into this sort of trajectory towards the Internet of Things and the relationship between these private sector actors and regulators in government. Because while they're driven by different motives, with tech companies being driven by profit and governments being driven by host of other more public sector oriented outcomes, the logics underpinning them and the way they use technology are more similar than we might at first think. So I'm going to go ahead and cut straight to that interview. Again, my guest is Bruce Schneier. He is the Chief Technology Officer at IBM Resilient, and his latest book is called Click Here to Kill Everybody, Security and Survival in a Hyperconnected World. Bruce, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So your book starts out by talking about how devices, everything from apparel to home appliances to automobiles, will be increasingly connected through systems. And we generally call that the Internet of Things. But I'd like to ask about a point you make early in the book where you think the term Internet of Things doesn't quite capture our human involvement with this system of systems. So you coined the term Internet Plus to more accurately describe this phenomenon. Can you start out by telling us what the Internet Plus is and why you decided to write a book about it?
Sure. And I can say that I kind of hate coining a new term. I always feel like there should be enough language out there. We don't have to invent new words. But what I wanted to describe and explain wasn't talked about in the way I wanted to. Internet of Things are the household common objects that will be on the internet. Our appliances, our cars, our thermostats, medical devices, toys, eventually our clothing and cheaper things. But when you think about security, and this is very much a book about security, you have to take a very holistic view of whatever system you're looking at. And those things, those consumer devices, are just one piece of the system. So it's the Internet of Things plus your phone, because your phone is probably how you control any Internet of Things things that you have, and plus your computer, and plus all the websites you visit, and plus the large databases of information that is yours that other people have, Gmail and Google Docs and Facebook photos, and then the connections between you and them, and on and on and on up to the large power plants, which are also on the internet. And I kept saying this plus that plus that plus that, and eventually got to Internet Plus. Don't know if the term will stick. I don't want to get stuck on it. But as a security person, you need to think as generally as possible.
Right. And you make the argument that as these networks become more complex and interconnected, the potential for catastrophic damage increases. So actually, the more sophisticated these systems get, the more vulnerable and potentially dangerous they are. Why is that?
Well, because sophisticated systems are more powerful. I mean, there's several arguments here. The first is that computers are getting very powerful. When you get to the Internet of Things and the Internet Plus, you have computers that can take direct physical action on the world. Unlike your phone or your computer, which is just data, these new computer systems, computer things, are automobiles, are medical devices, are power plants, are thermostats, that they're making changes in the world. They are potentially affecting life and property in a way that a spreadsheet never can. So simply because these systems are becoming more capable, they're becoming more dangerous. Right? The risks are greater of a hack. Right? It's a different hack if someone hacks your car than if they hack your phone, because the car is a much more powerful device. Also, they're becoming more critical into our system. Hey, you know, we've been talking about election computers for a bunch of years, but our business systems, our social systems, our banking systems, our communications, transportation, these are all based on computers and networks. They're all on the internet. And if they go down, if they're attacked, it's much, much worse. And then there's the connectivity, that these systems are connected to each other. And vulnerabilities in one thing affect other things. And we have an enormously complex system. I've given hour-long talks on this, and I'll just briefly say it. Complex systems are hard to secure, and the internet is the most complex machine mankind has ever built, by a lot. And that makes security very, very hard. So yes, I mean, these things are more powerful, and they give a lot of good. I mean, I never want to sound like I'm saying this is so dangerous, you shouldn't do it. You know, there's so much power in these connected systems, in social media, in physically capable computers, that these are great technologies, but they bring with them risks, right? So my book is about the risks that come as a side effect to these technologies.
And one of the things I thought was interesting in the book is, you know, while we have, you know, these powerful systems, these very complex systems, you also talk about this kind of consolidation of hardwares and softwares that you call this idea of a growing monoculture, which increases the risks of vulnerability for things like class breaks. So can you break down those concepts? I thought it was really interesting what monocultures are and why they might impact class breaks.
So this is something that we are used to in computer security that the rest of the world is not. And it's a way computers fail. And it's going to be the way everything fails. So we know how cars fail, right? Cars have parts. Parts have mean time between failures. Parts break. Cars break at some relatively constant rate through society. There are auto repair shops that fix cars, you know, as they break. This is all well understood. Computers break differently. They all work perfectly until one day when none of them do. Right, that is a failure mode of computers that regular things don't have. Right? Regular things don't all fail at once, pretty much ever. But computers do. So there's a story of last year. There's a lock manufacturer that sells computerized locks for hotels, those key card locks. The company is called Amity. And they sold these hotel room key card locks into thousands of hotels around the world, hundreds of thousands of hotel rooms, maybe millions. Someone found a vulnerability. Suddenly, all of those locks are vulnerable. All of those locks can be hacked. Someone can break into every hotel room that uses these locks around the world. So that's the monoculture. if there were 100, 1,000 different lock companies and they all sold a few locks to a few hotels, this break would be, you know, a little bit of news. If this is the only lock company in the world and this was the only product they sold, every hotel room would be vulnerable. You know, as it is, they're one of a few lock companies, so a whole bunch of hotel rooms are vulnerable. But there you see the monoculture, that as we rely on fewer and fewer things, these class breaks become more important. Traditionally, we think of it in computers, right? We either use Windows, or we use a Mac, or maybe we use a Chromebook. Possibly, we use Linux, so four operating systems. If there is a vulnerability in one of them, it is a big deal. Whether only two operating systems would be a bigger deal. If there were 20, it would be less of a big deal. And so that's monoculture, and it's something relatively new that is coming to things.
And would you consider like individual social media platforms or perhaps the genre as a whole as a type of monoculture? Because so many of us are on the same platforms through the same operating systems and devices. Does that interconnectedness across different accounts increase our vulnerability to class breaks?
It increases the effects of class breaks. Let's take Facebook, right? Most everyone has a Facebook account. If there was a breach in Facebook security, it could affect everybody. Just like last year, Equifax, one of the credit bureaus, had their accounts hacked and every one of our personal information was stolen, right? For pretty much every American had their personal data stolen because this was the one company, is one of three major credit bureaus, and it was a break that affected us all. So yes, you know, if there is a hack, and you'll see this, right? There's a hack of Twitter or Flickr or someone, and we're all told to change our passwords. Right? And that is the class break. It affects everybody. Now, social media networks are kind of naturally monopolies. Right? Nobody's on Facebook because they want to be on Facebook. They're on Facebook because their friends are on Facebook. They have to be on Facebook. And that accretion, that you're there because everyone else is there, and if you're not there, you miss party invites, means that we're all there, means that we're vulnerable. So it doesn't really increase our vulnerability to class breaks. What it increases is how damaging class breaks are, right? It's no more likely that Facebook gets hacked if they're, you know, depending on the number of users, but the effects are much greater. Now, you could argue that maybe it does increase the vulnerability. If you are, I'm going to make this up, the government of China, and you want to hack and get U.S. personal data, you're going to go where there's a lot of it, right? When China wanted to get personal data on Americans who worked for the government, they hacked the Office of Personnel Management. Why? Because the Office of Personnel Management had all of the files. If the files were distributed among 20 agencies, there's less of a monoculture, we would have been safer. Right? So there is this inherent safety in diversity and in decentralization, which is very much the opposite of what all these social media companies want.
Yeah, and that leads very well into my next question, which is about this idea of surveillance capitalism, which you describe as a kind of mechanism that underpins this development of monocultures, that it's different whether you're a private or public actor, right? If you're a big tech company, you're after profits, but if you're a government, you're after something else. But the dynamics are quite the same. So can you go into that idea of surveillance companies and kind of how it drives the internet and how the relationship between tech companies and government is linked by surveillance capitalism?
Sure. So this is an important term. Is invented by Shoshana Zuboff. She is a Harvard Business School professor. She just wrote a book, which will be published, I think, any minute now, called The Rise of Surveillance Capitalism. And what she looks at is this very new business model, this business model of surveillance. And this is what the internet is based on. It is the business model of the internet. Take an easy company, Facebook. Right? They make their money spying on their users and selling the knowledge gained from that spying to their customers, to advertisers, for the purpose of psychological manipulation, advertising, persuasion, whatever you want to call it. That's their business model. It's kind of a creepy business model when I explain it that way, but you look at pretty much any internet company, that's what they're doing. They are spying on us and using that information to control us or to manipulate us. Right? That's the business. That's the underpinning of everything. Governments actually also like this information, and they use it for different purposes. China is building a very complex surveillance infrastructure for all of their citizens, hand in hand with the corporations, for the purpose of social control, for scoring citizens based on how obedient they are and how little they make waves. And so whatever their social control criteria is, you know, they want to have scores and give people what they call social credit, give people capabilities and rights and privileges based on their score. And of course, the goal is to make sure people want their score to be high. They don't do anything that will disrupt the government. And that infrastructure is very detailed and goes hand in hand with the Chinese social media companies that are doing their natural surveillance. In the U.S. and other Western countries, the governments also want some of this data. For us, it's for law enforcement. It's for possibly finding terrorists. You know, it's not the broad surveillance of everybody. It's more the targeted surveillance of people we want to keep tabs on. But of course, that includes immigrants and peace rights groups and, you know, a lot of political figures. You go to other countries, right? Mexico uses this surveillance to spy on political opponents. You go to Kazakhstan, you go to Syria, Sudan, Ethiopia, right? Used to spy on human rights groups, political opponents, journalists. Everybody wants to use this data. Right? But fundamentally, it is generated by the computers we use. Right? The computers we use naturally generate data. The companies over the past couple of decades have realized it is valuable. They're using it for their purposes. And now here comes the change. The Internet of Things is really the Internet of Sensors. That all of these things in our lives, these appliances and thermostats and cars and medical devices, will collect a lot of intimate data about us. And that intimate data, like all the intimate data we leave on Facebook, will be collected and correlated and used and sold by the companies that provide those products to us.
And so in the Chinese case, for example, you know, we're looking at governments surveying their citizens, but you spend quite a bit of time in the book talking about what happens when governments are trying to get data from other governments or government agencies, and this idea of patching vulnerabilities in a system to make systems more secure is not always in a government's interest. So could you describe the current arms race between states in terms of cyber capabilities and why you think more security is the best way forward?
So there is an arms race. You know, we are using cyber capabilities to eavesdrop on each other, to attack each other. Now, we saw examples. I talked about the Chinese government hacking the U.S. Office of Personnel Management and stealing personnel data on, I think, 20 million Americans. We've heard stories of the Russian government hacking into U.S. power plants. We've talked about the Russian government hacking into U.S. voting systems. We know the U.S. has used cyber operations against North Korea. North Korea has used cyber operations against the United States. I can sort of go on and on. There is these cyber operations, mostly espionage, sometimes more offensive, happening in the world. Right? And countries, intelligence agencies, cyber commands like the insecurities of the internet because it allows them to act offensively. Right? So the NSA, U.S. Cyber Command, uses these vulnerabilities legitimately, right, to go after our enemies in ways that we probably like, we probably think is a good idea. And other countries do as well. So you'll see this, the FBI talks about the need to get into iPhones in their quest to solve crimes, and they want vulnerabilities in iPhones that they can use. Apple says, no, that doesn't make sense. We want our iPhones to be secure, and too bad. And that's really been this offense-defense tension. What's changing is that these computers, these systems, are now being used for more critical applications. So when you have phones and computers and IoT devices that are controlling our power plants and our airplanes and our cars and are being used by our legislators, that suddenly, or maybe gradually, defense becomes more important. that the cost of insecure systems is much greater than it used to be, and it will get greater every year. So for the government to say, you know, we need to make this offense-defense balance, we think offense should win, is now ludicrous. That defense has to dominate. That we need systems that are as secure as they can be, even if it means it'll be harder for us to spy on our enemies, because the danger of not doing that becomes so great.
And apart from, you know, just patching the vulnerability in a system, one of the things that you argue can make the Internet Plus more secure is encryption. And I know you're an expert in cryptography, so I was wondering if you could explain briefly kind of the technology behind encryption.
So encryption, secret codes. It's the technology is way more math than I will bore you with, but basically these are technologies to secure the things we do on the internet. Now, traditionally, when you think of encryption, you think of privacy, of confidentiality, right? Protect my data. And certainly a lot of the attacks we read about are attacks against privacy and confidentiality. That's the Office of Personnel Management. China stole my data. That's Equifax, right? Hackers and criminals stole my data. That's Target Corporation, or, you know, everything we read about is that. But encryption does more than protect privacy. It protects integrity, right? So is the data accurate? Not that anyone steal it. Did anyone change it? It protects availability. Can I get to my data? And when you move to physically capable computers, these integrity and availability threats become much greater than the confidentiality threats. So I'll give a couple of examples, right? You know, I am concerned that someone might hack into my hospital and steal my private patient medical records, right? That is a confidentiality threat. And I would use encryption to protect those patient records. But I'm actually much more concerned if someone hacks into my hospital and changes my blood type, right? That is a data integrity attack. Nobody stole anything, right? You change someone's blood type, you might kill them. Another example, take a car, right? I don't want someone to hack into my car, turn on the Bluetooth microphone, and eavesdrop on my conversations, right? That is a data privacy attack. But I really don't want them to hack into my car and disable the brakes. That is a data availability attack. So, and this is what I talk about in my book. When you get to a world of physically capable computers, the integrity and availability attacks become catastrophic, right? They affect life and property in a way that a confidentiality attack doesn't.
And, you know, moving away from this idea of encryption to its kind of exact opposite, which is being more public, you outline tons of prescriptive solutions for how to make the internet and eventually the Internet Plus more secure, safer, and better. And you write that the Internet Plus must be public to be trusted, and you place a big emphasis on trust. So I wonder, like, wasn't that the original intent of the internet, this kind of World Wide Web? Wasn't that kind of always what it was supposed to be?
You know, supposed to is a complicated term. You know, way back in the early days of the internet, it was very different than it is today. Right? It wasn't used for anything important. You had limited access. And yes, it was much more open because it was this system that didn't matter, where you had to be a bona fide researcher to have access to it. Now that it's used for everything by everybody, you have a lot of profit centers. Right? Right now, the internet is driven by business. It's driven by profit. So you're not going to get that same kind of open mentality, right? Facebook doesn't want to open their system to everybody, right? That means they put they leave profit on the table. They want it to be closed. They want the data you have to be on their site. You can't get it out, so you go back on Facebook. It's it's a very different world.
And I mean, kind of sticking on this idea of trust, social media. It's interesting. There are spaces where we have interactions with trusted ones, but the companies themselves, the platforms, were increasingly mistrusting, whether that's because of the Cambridge Analytica scandal or this scandal around free speech on Twitter. So I want to ask, as publics increasingly mistrust the corporations that create those monocultures that we were talking about earlier, what's the role of government here? Like, what can government do?
I write about this a lot in my book. I think government is the missing ingredient in a lot of these problems. that government, sort of two ways. Think about it. Government is how we express ourselves as citizens and not as consumers. And as consumers, we tend to go for the bright, shiny thing and the thing that's free and the thing that's easy, the thing that, you know, we've been manipulated into accepting and the thing we didn't read. You know, we just do the thing. But as citizens, we are more considered, we're more reflective, we tend to make decisions based on our values more. And government is how that gets reflected into the environment. In the area of security, or even, you know, what you're talking about of trust, government is how trust gets enabled. You know, I got on an airplane this morning and I didn't inspect the plane. I didn't look at the engine. I trusted that there is this magical system that puts well-maintained aircraft at gates and puts well-rested and well-trained pilots in cockpits on schedule, on demand, kind of by magic. And it's not by magic. It's because there's a lot of government rules about what airlines have to do. And that provides me with a safe, not necessarily comfortable, but safe flying experience that I can trust blindly without even thinking about it. So if we want that same kind of feeling on the internet with social media companies, with internet-connected cars, with anything, government needs to play a much stronger role in setting the rules. It's simply the way it works.
And one of the ways that you advocate for this is a closer integration between policymakers and tech professionals, or people who are sort of younger and getting into tech. And that relates to this idea of cyber peace. So could you describe the sort of path forward in terms of what you see as getting us to cyber peace and how that closer integration between tech and policy can help us get there?
So this is something I feel passionately about. And, you know, it's probably a sort of a good thing to sum up all these arguments. That we're in a world where our major policy problems are deeply technical. We've been talking about security, computer security, Internet of Things security, technological security. There's a lot of policy decisions to be made on how we should achieve this, but they require some deep tech understanding. And we will never get the policy right if we get the tech wrong. That's not just true for my field. That's true for artificial intelligence. That's true for the future of work. That's true for food safety. That's true for climate change. And all of those topics are going to affect society in profound ways. They require some very novel and interesting and well thought out policy responses. But if you don't know the tech, you're going to mess up the policy. And so what I think we need in this century is for technologists to get involved in public policy, to work on legislative staffs, in federal agencies, at the press, at NGOs, at universities, that bringing these two things together and helping solve our problems. It's a hard demand, but I think it's vital.
And I want to push you on one last question, which is precisely because of our own role as humans in the Internet Plus, won't there always be human error? So no matter how secure a system is, or, you know, how leak-proof it is from vulnerabilities, won't there always be a risk of social engineering, which kind of relates to our fundamental flaws as humans?
There are all sorts of risks. Nothing is absolutely secure, but nothing in society is, right? You know, no matter what you do. You know, driving or walking down the street or eating or, you know, meeting a new friend, nothing is without risk. Life itself is risk. We're okay with that, right? That's been true since there were human beings. It's even true before there were human beings. It'll always be true. And the question is, how do we best manage these risks? I mean, what can we do to minimize them, to contain them, to ensure that small risks don't become catastrophic? And that's what we're doing here. You know, we're never going to say computers will never be hacked, there'll never be another earthquake, fire will cease to exist, there'll be no more viruses. Right? That's not what we're looking for. We're looking for a world where we can manage all of those risks. in a way that allows us to thrive as individuals.
Well, I think that it will be a good place to stop, knowing there will always be risks. But Bruce, thank you so much for taking the time out. This has been great.
Thanks for having me.
I've just been speaking with Bruce Schneier, Chief Technology Officer at IBM Resilient and a fellow at the Berkman Klein Center at Harvard University. Check out the book, Click Here to Kill Everybody, Security and Survival in a Hyper-Connected World. And if you want to know more about Bruce, you can visit his website at schneier.com. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you again for tuning in. I've got some great interviews coming up looking at the 2018 midterm election, so stay tuned for that. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast. Visit the website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.